time again for Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Today, a special edition of the show devoted to questions about what's in the environment around us. The food we eat, the clothes we wear, the furniture we sit on. From antibiotics in livestock to flame retardants in children's pajamas, what is a real threat to human health and what is just noise from the internet? How are big providers, from farmers to fast food companies and retailers, responding to consumer demand for food without antibiotics and products without substances linked to risks of cancer? Joining us to sort through fact and fiction are two award-winning journalists, Maren McKenna, contributing writer to National Geographic, and Michael Hawthorne of the Chicago Tribune. Midday on the Bay, after the news. Welcome back to Midday. Time for Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell, reporter of the Chesapeake Bay Journal, who joins us here once a month. Today, a special edition of the show, as I said from the outset, devoted to questions about what's in the environment around us, the food we eat, the clothes we wear, the furniture we sit on. Lots of questions about antibiotics in livestock, chemicals that end up being used as flame retardants in furniture and children's pajamas. So we're going to spend some time on the show today separating fact from fiction a bit. What is a real threat to human health? And what is just, as Rona Cabell put it, noise from the internet? That's coming up a bit later on in our show. Actually, in just a few minutes, we'll be joined by Maren McKenna, who is a contributing writer to National Geographic and other journals, and Michael Hawthorne of the Chicago Tribune. Both have done extensive reporting in those fields. But first, we're going to talk a bit about some of the issues that came up in the General Assembly that are related to the environment, to the Chesapeake Bay, and Rona's here with us. Rona, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too. Thank you.
Let's just talk about some of these bills that came through the legislature, and then that'll be the first segment of our show, and then we'll get to Maren and Michael during the rest of the hour. Can we start with the stormwater fee?
Oh, my favorite topic.
We went over this a little bit with Chris Connolly of the WIPR staff the day after the legislature ended, which was Monday night.
Right.
And, you know, we had the new governor, Larry Hogan. Part of his campaign last year was to repeal the rain tax, the stormwater remediation fees that became mandatory in Baltimore and the nine largest jurisdictions next to Baltimore.
Right. So what happened was in 2012, they passed a stormwater management fee that required all of the nine largest counties in Baltimore City to basically just set up a utility fee to charge these jurisdictions for improvements to the stormwater infrastructure. It didn't tell them how much to charge or what to improve. It just said you have to improve it. And the reason for that was they all have these permits that they get from the Maryland Department of the Environment, and many of them were in violation of the permits. And they said that they were violating the permits because they didn't have the money. So this
didn't have the money to correct
right,
the amount of stormwater that was running off into the gullies and ditches and creeks into the bay, right?
Right. So yeah. It is because in some places there's a combined sewage and stormwater. In other places, it's just the stormwater outfalls are outdated. Where I live, I can kind of just watch the dirty water going right into the stream. So, every place had different problems, which is why they kind of set it up as a cafeteria approach. You choose which way you want to do it. But as we all know, this became known as the rain tax. And the Republican politicians, in particular Larry Hogan, vowed that they would repeal it. So what happened was they didn't exactly repeal it. What they did was repeal the mandatory fee, but all of these jurisdictions still have to follow their permits. So they're going to have to figure out a way to meet their permits. And I predict that quietly over the next 3 or 4 years, they'll do what 16 other jurisdictions around the country have done and create stormwater utility fees, because there really isn't any other way to do it. You have to charge people to raise the money to fix the problems.
We discussed this a lot on the show.
Yes.
You know, my idea was just to do something the way, handle this the way you handle the so-called flush tax.
I think right? That's a great idea.
Charge everybody a standard fee, upgrade to, in that case, to upgrade wastewater treatment plants all
right.
around the state, from Garrett County to the Eastern Shore. And do something similar here with this.
And the reason they didn't
simplify it.
The reason they didn't do that, Dan, because I made that very point several times, they felt that it was an unfair burden for the rural counties because much of the stormwater problems comes from places with impervious surface, places like Baltimore. However, cities like Salisbury and Berlin are just doing this on their own. They recognize they have a problem, and even though they are not part of the 9 counties in Baltimore that are being required, they're making these changes on their own.
Hey, before we leave that topic, for the homeowner, for somebody who actually wants to do something on their own besides just pay a fee and grumble about it, list something. Describe something you can do this spring to make this a little bit better for all of us.
Certainly,
your own backyard.
A rain barrel is a good start. I think applying less pesticides to your lawn, that doesn't necessarily reduce your runoff, but it makes your runoff cleaner. And then your lawn will look more like mine, and I won't be the only one in the neighborhood with a weedy lawn. So those are two things you can do. A lot of people are really going above and beyond. They're ripping up driveways and they're putting in rain gardens. And, you know, these things are expensive solutions, but I think they're excellent ideas.
You mentioned pesticides. Let's talk about that here. There's a lot of concern about bees dying off, in particular related to the use of pesticides.
Well, this became kind of a battle between the scientists and Bayer, which is one of the companies that manufactures these, what they're called neonicotinoids. And it's a pesticide that is intended to kill weeds, but also kills bees. And so the beekeepers came to Annapolis trying to promote the cause of the bees and talk about how there's been this really massive bee die-off in the whole country. And for a while, it was largely unexplained, but research has pointed to these neonicotinoids, and they wanted to get a ban in place. But what they got instead was Delegate Kumar Bhave promising to study it over the summer. But interestingly, while this was all going on, Lowe's, the big home improvement store, voluntarily said that it will stop using neonicotinoids. And I think what's happening, as we'll see in some of these other cases that Michael and Marin will talk about, is the consumers are forcing this issue. They're forcing these large big box retailers not to sell these products. They're asking for products without these chemicals. And that's sort of driving the bus.
Interesting piece of legislation regarding plastic microbeads.
Right.
I read something about this in passing a couple of months ago, and then I meant to follow up. I'm glad you have this on your list of things to talk about.
This was a surprise to me, Dan, because as we know, Annapolis can take 3, 4, or 5 years to pass even good legislation.
Yes. Yeah.
So basically, we became aware that these sort of, they're called polyethylene, these balls that are used in toothpaste and shampoo.
Tiny, tiny little things.
Tiny little things. So
why are they in toothpaste and shampoo?
Oh, they make your skin soft. They make your toothpaste feel good. And so what happens is you brush your teeth, the toothpaste goes down the drain, the water goes to the wastewater treatment plant, it gets treated and released. And all of the sort of larger pieces get treated, but these microbeads, they don't break down. And so what happens is they go into the Chesapeake Bay or the ocean or the Great Lakes, and they remain. And marine life, you know, small crabs, worms, chokes on them and can't live. And in the Great Lakes, about 90% of the plastics, I think, are from these little microbeads. So Illinois was the first state to ban microbeads. And ever since they did it a couple years ago, other states have been following. California, Minnesota, and Oregon are all working on it. Maryland just passed its ban. New Jersey. And so I think one of the reasons why this passed, two reasons. One, Julie Lawson of Trash Free Maryland went around Annapolis with a jar full of dirty water with these little beads in it, showing everybody that this is what we're doing. And the other reason is that unlike the rain fee and stormwater, we don't have to pay anything for this. Johnson & Johnson and Procter & Gamble and these companies will just take it out. So we don't have to do anything. We buy our toothpaste the way we always did. So it was sort of a taxpayer-friendly bill, if you will, in that we didn't have to do anything. And
okay,
the companies have been getting on board, again, because of the consumer pressure to support these bills.
It was in shampoos. It was in body wash, too, like
yes,
liquid soaps.
Right. And
can I just ask you, doesn't it seem kind of amazing that this was even allowed to happen to begin with? What you know, that these companies got approval to put little tiny plastic beads in stuff?
It does.
That we use in the shower?
I don't think it was intentional. Like, let's put something in that's going to kill marine life and
no,
and
I understand.
The oceans.
Just also the idea of brushing your teeth
right
with little tiny plastic microbeads in there?
Well, before the show, I did look.
I thought it was poppy seed in between my teeth. Maybe it was the, you know.
Before the show, I looked at the back of my toothpaste just to see what else was in it. And, you know, it's a little bit of a frightening scenario when you think about all of the chemicals that you don't know that you're using every day. I went to a rendering plant once, and they told me that they make cosmetics out of the animals. And yeah. I thought, that's it. No more makeup for me. Mm-hmm. So, I mean.
All right. Well, I'm glad they settled that and without costing taxpayers anything.
Right. That was good.
All right. And as far as the stormwater management fee that we just left behind, finally we're done with, this isn't going away. Someone's going to have to pay.
Right. And it is the largest source of urban pollution that's reaching the bay at this point, and we do have to take care of it.
The other big issue that the governor settled, and settled quite well, I think, looked pretty good, was the phosphorus management tool, you know, what to do with chicken manure.
Right. And this was the most important issue in the legislative session was actually not legislation at all. It was regulation.
Right.
But legislation forced Larry Hogan's hand, I think, because he started out by saying that phosphorus was going to be his first fight, that there was not going to be a phosphorus management tool. And then Paul Pinsky and Steve Lafferty, members of the legislature, right, introduced O'Malley's phosphorus management tool as legislation. And farmers prefer a regulation to a legislation because with regulation, they can kind of work with it and tweak it. But legislation is much harder to do. You have to pass another bill to undo what was done. Mm-hmm. So Hogan came back with a pretty modest proposal that had a couple loopholes, but it was pretty much looked like a phosphorus management tool to me. And the two sides worked on it and they put it into the Maryland Register. And we are going to have a phosphorus management tool. And I think it's amazing news.
Okay, so he ended up proposing something that looked very much like what Martin O'Malley had put in place before he left as governor.
Right.
Okay, so we have this phosphorus management tool that farmers are going to have to dispose of their chicken manure in different ways now.
Right. Essentially, they're going to have to put less of it on the ground.
It's already saturated with phosphorus.
Right. And in fact, Hogan's proposal in a way went further than O'Malley's because he said immediately the fields that are highest in phosphorus cannot have any more as soon as this goes into effect. And O'Malley's didn't go quite that far. So I think it was really good. I think it was gutsy. I think he deserves credit for it because, to be honest, you know, 4 months ago we were on the show talking about it and I didn't think it was going to happen. So it is a big deal. There have been complaints that it's going to be slower and take longer and it's not going to be there's a delay upon a delay. And I agree with all of that, but it's still extremely significant that we got it at all.
Thank you for these updates, Rona Cabell, of course, of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. It's Rona's idea that we move on to the next topic, which is really of high interest to our listeners. We're bombarded with information about the hazards in our home, potential hazards in our home, in our food, in our environment. How do we know what's really harmful and what isn't? Joining us will be two award-winning journalists who spend their days looking into these issues. As we move on to that topic, we'll take a short break here on Midday, Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell of the Bay Journal. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. It's our April edition of Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. And Rona, so tell us a little bit about what you were thinking when you decided we should present these topics today about hazards in our environment, the toxins that are in some of the, you know, products that we use and sometimes the things we eat.
It's something I always wanted to know more about. I touch on this in my reporting, but as you know, I'm a little more focused on manure and oysters and things like that. Mm. And I think there's a lot of noise out there. It's often really hard to tell if something is harmful. And there's a lot of people taking the name of a chemical and deciding that that's harmful and petitioning to get it out of foods, when in fact, that chemical, slightly tweaked, is completely harmless. And we saw this with Subway had to recall a whole bunch of bread because it had some chemical in it that turns out to be completely benign. Mm-hmm. But such a fuss was made out of it. So I just thought that bringing in two real experts on this topic to kind of help us sort through some of these issues would help us in our everyday decisions.
And Maren McKenna is one of those. She's written a lot about this topic, taking a hard look at antibiotics, for instance, the use of antibiotics in agriculture. She's a journalist and author of Superbug and Beating Back the Devil, which Rona says is a great narrative of the time spent tracking the Epidemic Intelligence Service. And Maren McKenna is working on a new book about antibiotic resistance. She's a contributing writer now for National Geographic and has also written for Wired, Slate, and The Atlantic. So, Maren, thank you for joining us here on the Midday Show.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, as Rona says, lots of antibiotics, lots of stories, lots of talk about antibiotics in our food chain, I say, in livestock. So why don't we start with a question about how it got into agriculture in the first place?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. So the use of antibiotics when we talk about antibiotics in agriculture, what we're really most concerned about is giving antibiotics to meat animals as they're raised. Now, antibiotics are also used in other kinds of food. They're used especially in shrimp farming and to some degree in fish farming, though mostly not in this country. And they're used in fruit agriculture to keep down diseases of fruit like apples and pears and grapes. But the biggest use by far is giving antibiotics routinely to meat animals, to cattle, to hogs, to chicken, as they're raised. Not because they're sick, but because the drugs have other effects beside curing illness. And this use actually goes back, I've discovered in my research, to the very beginning of the antibiotic era in the late 1940s, where out of a complicated set of reasons having to do with the end of World War II and concerns about the food supply and kind of a sort of unthinking belief in the narrative of science, that people decided that feeding antibiotics to meat animals every day would be a good thing. And it went on that way for decades.
Maren, what are the other effects besides, keeping animals from getting sick?
Sure. So there's two ways that these drugs get used in meat animals. The first to be discovered and the one that people are most concerned about when they talk about this in a policy manner is something called growth promotion, or sometimes called feed efficiency. What that is if you give tiny doses of antibiotics to animals, much smaller doses than would be needed to cure an illness, for instance, what happens is that the animals put on weight, put on muscle mass, the stuff that we eat, faster than they would have without the drug. Or you can give them a smaller amount of food and they get as big as if they were getting a larger amount of food without the antibiotic. Now, if what you want to do is to move animals through the process of raising them faster, then something that makes an animal get fat faster so you can sell it faster looks like a good thing.
Right. So, Maren, I'm wondering, like, when you eat the chicken, do you then, your antibiotic resistance lessens? Is that the case?
Not exactly. So there's this is a little complicated, so let me walk you through it. What happens is that we give these animals these tiny doses of antibiotics, and those doses affect the bacteria that live in the animal's guts, what these days we would call the microbiome, though back in the 1940s they didn't use that word. All of us, every living being on the planet, is covered in bacteria internally and externally, and many of those bacteria are either neutral to us or beneficial to us. But once we take antibiotics, and this is actually true for people too, it changes the balance of the bacteria in our guts. Now, in the case of animals and growth promoters, what's probably going on is that it's changing the balance of bacteria in such a way that it increases their uptake of nutrients. So they use the food they're getting more efficiently. But those are such small doses that it's not as though there's a residue of antibiotic in the animals once they're slaughtered. Residues can happen if you're giving enough antibiotics to cure an illness and then slaughtering the animal, and that happens sometimes with dairy cattle, for instance. But in the case of growth promoters, what we're worried about is not actually the antibiotic itself staying behind. It's the changed bacteria that were affected by those tiny doses of antibiotics. So those bacteria have now been encouraged to become resistant. And that resistance travels with the meat that those animals become into our kitchens or onto our plates or into a restaurant kitchen. And we pick them up and potentially develop a resistant infection as a result.
So do you think that the growers of the chicken and the meat and the pork, do you think that they don't need to use antibiotics at all? Do you feel that they could maybe use them in a better way, or could we just completely cut them from the food supply?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because this use of antibiotics in this manner for growth promotion and for a secondary use called prophylaxis, which is basically keeping animals in that are held in really tight conditions, such as the giant houses in which chickens are raised in, keeping them from getting sick from the conditions they're raised in. That those practices were adopted by agriculture really rapidly and really comprehensively in the 1950s. So it's sort of been this natural experiment in which, except for organic raising and more recently for, let's call it, pasture-based or grass-fed raising, no one's ever really tried, at least in the United States, to go without these drugs. However, Europe has been ahead of the United States for a couple of decades now in placing restrictions on these kind of antibiotics. So various, both Europe as a whole and various countries within Europe, have put curbs on ways in which antibiotics can be used in meat raising. And when they have cut back on those antibiotic doses that we take for granted, it turns out that they can take a lot of antibiotics out of their systems without really affecting the bottom line. Sometimes they have to do things like change their raising practices a little, wean animals a little later, give them a little more space, heat their barns a little more. But I spent a number of weeks in the Netherlands last year, which is the country that now has the tightest controls on agricultural antibiotic use. And farmer after farmer there told me that the curbs really had not made a difference to their bottom line.
You say in a piece that you wrote, Maren McKenna, for Modern Farmer called The Abstinence Method, you write here, since 2009, Dutch farmers have cut animal drug use by half without harming either animal welfare or their own profits. 4 years into the project, their accomplishment has huge implications for farming throughout the world. So I'm curious, I haven't had a chance to finish reading your piece. How did this go over in the beginning? Was there resistance from farmers to cutting back so much?
So the really interesting thing about the Dutch experiment is that it wasn't something imposed from above. Rather, it was a collaboration between that country's Ministry of Agriculture, the equivalent of our USDA, and the major producer groups in the country. So their equivalent of our Pork Producers Council, Chicken Council, things like that. The Ministry of Agriculture first raised the issue of reducing antibiotic use because they were having a real struggle with epidemics of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in humans that, thanks to molecular tracing, they could point back to farms and say, this is coming from animals. So their Ministry of Agriculture took this to the meat-producing sectors, asked them to go in on a voluntary cooperative reduction, and everyone agreed. And within, as that story says, and as you quoted, within 2 years, from 2010 to 2012, they got down to they took 50% of the antibiotics out of their meat agriculture. And they were so excited that they'd done that. They actually got to the goal a year faster than they thought, that they said they were going to go for 70%. And that's what they're working on now. And over those years, since 2010, you can see both antibiotic-resistant bacteria in animals and now, lagging by a couple of years, antibiotic-resistant bacteria affecting humans, both really trending down in the country. It's really clear.
Boy, I can see why you state that there'd be implications around the world for that. So here in the United States, we go shopping, go to the supermarket, and you've started to see more often antibiotic-free on labels, especially on chicken, I think. I don't know if I've noticed it as much on beef or pork, but I certainly have noticed it on some chicken labeling. And can you just talk a little bit about where that comes from? How much can we trust it? Is the government involved in regulating that labeling?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting development. And what I think it speaks to is the power of consumers, because this has been this process has been going for probably about 10 years now without us really noticing. And the reason it started is because of consumer pressure. So if you went into just your average big supermarket, you would see that for any major chicken, let's talk about chicken, any major chicken integrator, producer, for Tyson's, for Purdue, for Pilgrim's Pride, pretty much every single one of those companies has a label that is now antibiotic-free. And they came up with this initially on their own. Now, there's also organic labeling, and there's also natural, and all of those labels have different meanings. But each of the major companies has now committed to doing antibiotic-free chicken because they've heard from consumers that that's what they want. Now, what that means in the case of chicken is that they have ruled out, they have ceased to use almost all of the drugs that we would consider, the antibiotics that we would consider growth promoters. For the most part, they are still using a category of antibiotics that are called ionophores. In chickens, what ionophores do is control a parasitic disease called coccidiosis that is really problematic in chicken houses. It's not such a big deal for chickens that are raised out on pasture. Coccidiosis can really go through a flock and can really cut into a farmer's bottom line. But the drugs that are used against coccidiosis are not used in human medicine. And so the FDA has said, and the USDA have said, we're really okay with chicken farmers continuing to use this one category of drugs because they're not going to affect bacteria in a way that would be problematic if those bacteria ever got into humans, because the drug that we would be reaching for to cure those bacteria is not one that's approved for use in humans. So if resistance happens, it doesn't really matter.
Hmm.
Well, I did a story, I guess about a year ago, for Modern Farmer also, about Purdue getting into the antibiotic chicken business. And they had bought a small company in Pennsylvania, and they were selling antibiotic-free chicken. And from what I remember of the story, it had well exceeded their expectations in terms of sales, and they were going to start growing more chickens in this manner, and they were thinking that this was going to be a real growth area for them. So they were responding not so much to the health concern, but to the consumer desire. And I think from what you're saying, that sounds like the direction that we're kind of heading in.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. And what you were seeing up there, I have been seeing down here in the South as well. I live in Atlanta, so I have talked to plenty of sort of traditional conventional chicken farmers, numbers of whom have told me that the complexes that they're in, the areas of chicken farms that feed particular production or slaughterhouses, have been turning over to no antibiotics or no antibiotics ever. The acronym changes a little depending on which company you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I do wonder, though, if it has one of its qualities, if you want to call it that, is growth promotion. Mm-hmm. The farmers, American farmers or farmers anywhere, would be concerned about, who do this on a big scale, would be concerned about the yield that they would get for chicken or other livestock, beef. They just wouldn't produce as much protein without the antibiotics.
So the folks that I've talked to who are conventional chicken farmers have been telling me that their yields are not that different.
Hmm.
And that may be because, without our really noticing, the chicken sector particularly had actually been cutting back on antibiotics for a while. This goes back to about 2002 or 2003, when the FDA and USDA said that that poultry producers could no longer use a particular class of drugs that were very popular at the time called fluoroquinolones. And those were really important in chicken raising. And when they outlawed those being used in poultry, that really left only the ionophores, those drugs that are not used in human medicine, as a major category of use in chickens. There's a few other antibiotic classes that are still being used, not in growth promotion, but in sort of in that next step up. But it turns out, you know, if you look back across these 10 years, that drug reduction was already happening, and it was happening because of a mix of some regulatory but a lot of market pressure. So the chicken sector in particular, probably more than hogs or cattle, was kind of getting used to this idea of cutting back on drugs.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. I just wonder how far this will go, because we also hear about it in the dairy industry too, right? I think I've seen some milk, perhaps some cheese, antibiotic-free. By the way, Chef Brian Voltaggio, who was on our show in the previous hour, I asked him about this when we weren't on the air, and he says that his supply now is, I think he talked about chicken in particular, was coming from a farm that was antibiotic-free.
I would like to add that the studio smells like fried chicken.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, he brought in a bag of fried chicken from his restaurant.
Top Chef fried chicken.
Yeah.
So I just want to respond to what you said about dairy.
About dairy, yes.
This is an important difference between cattle, hogs, and chicken, and dairy. So there's an important difference between meat cattle and dairy cattle, let's say. And the difference is that a dairy cow is an animal that you hang on to for quite a while. And so that animal represents more of an investment than perhaps a chicken that only lives for 42 days, or a hog that lives for a couple of months, or, you know, a meat calf that lives for a year. Dairy cattle go for several years. Therefore, for a dairy farmer, it makes more sense to actually treat an animal for illness than in addition to the other kinds of antibiotic use that go on in the animals that are only for meat. Since dairy cattle can get treated for illnesses and recover and go on to continue delivering their product, which is milk, there are different and much stricter rules about how antibiotics can be used to cure illnesses in them. And so when you see, for instance, you might sometimes see notices saying that dairy farm X has been enjoined from selling cattle or from selling milk because antibiotic residues have been found in the meat or in the milk. What happened in that case was a cow was treated for illness, and either the milk was sold or the cow was sold for meat before the end of the mandated withdrawal time, which is to say the amount of time that has to elapse between stopping the drugs and selling the milk or meat. But those are treatment doses of drugs, much larger than growth promoters. So it's really kind of a different use of antibiotics than what we've just been talking about.
Thank you, Maren.
I just wanted to say that, Maren, you're such a beautiful writer, and I saw this article that you had written about antibiotic resistance that talked about, was it your uncle or your great-uncle
and
polio?
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could just share a little bit about how that experience shaped how you write.
Oh, that's so kind of you for asking. Thank you. Yeah, so there was this story in my family, and I actually didn't find out about it until after I'd started writing about antibiotic resistance as a journalist. My father was named for his uncle, his father's younger brother. And all I knew about this guy growing up was that he had died young. And it wasn't until after my father had died and after I'd gotten interested in antibiotic resistance that I discovered that he died of an infection. He was a fireman in New York City. He was injured on the job, not burned, but just cut or bruised in the firehouse. And he developed what at the time they would have called blood poisoning, which is a whole body bacterial infection, fever and chills and delirium. And he died of it after several weeks with the infection. He died in 1938. That was 3 years before the first tests of penicillin. So to me, my great uncle represents what life was like before antibiotics came along, when the smallest injury, a cut, a scratch, a contusion, could potentially mean the end of your life. And the reason that story is so resonant to me is not just because it echoed through my family for generations, but also because antibiotic resistance has gotten so bad that we kind of stand on the edge of the post-antibiotic era, sort of like out right. The other end of the era of antibiotics that hadn't yet started when my great uncle died. Mm. We're now almost out of the other end of that, where simple infections like the one he had could potentially kill people again because these drugs no longer work. The drugs that weren't available to him may someday not be available to us either.
Maren McKenna, I thank you for spending some time with us explaining this today on the Midday Show. Maren McKenna is now a contributing writer to National Geographic. You can read her essay, Why I Care About Food. You can find a link to that on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, and also the article we mentioned from Modern Farmer about Dutch farmers and antibiotics. Thank you very much, Maren.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Spending some time in this special hour of Midday on the Bay, taking a look at what are the real threats to human health and what is just internet noise. What about household products? What about our couches and children's pajamas? There are all kinds of warnings about flame retardants. Are you supposed to buy the pajamas that fit snugly or the ones that don't? And what about the BPA in bottles that that was so dangerous and was it replaced by something worse? Some questions we'll tackle in the next segment of the show when Michael Hawthorne of the Chicago Tribune joins us here on Midday on the Bay. And welcome back to Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Dan Rodericks here. And joining us by phone now from Chicago is Michael Hawthorne of the Tribune. Michael is a longtime investigative reporter who's focused on the environment. He's won many awards over the years, including nearly every top prize in journalism for a series called Playing with Fire. That was a Tribune series that you might have read in the Baltimore Sun or BaltimoreSun.com. It was about flame retardants. Much of that series, I believe, ran in the Sun. And it was also, it became the basis for an HBO documentary called Toxic Hot Seat about the cancers that afflict firefighters and others who come into contact with these chemicals. So I want to thank Michael Hawthorne from the Tribune for joining us here on the Midday Show. Hi, Michael.
Hey, great to be with you, Dan and Rona.
Rona, you want to start a question for Michael?
Right. I always ask Michael all my toxic questions because he's really well-versed in this. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about why the Toxic Substance Control Act actually regulates so few substances.
This is a federal law.
The federal law.
Yeah, this is a law that was, Congress passed it in 1976. That's how old it is. And it's the only environmental law that Congress has passed that hasn't been updated since it was originally enacted. There's a big debate going on in Congress. You might not be hearing too much about it right now, given all the budget battles and whatnot going on in the political pre-presidential campaign hijinks in Congress. But there has been this move, long move, to reform that law, because what's happened over time is the Environmental Protection Agency has been unable to address just scores of these chemicals that are showing up in our bodies from products, household products like your household couch or the toy that your child plays with and puts in their mouth. What the law has essentially done, or what doesn't do, is give the EPA much of an ability to A, test the safety of a product, and B, do anything about it if dangers are actually found. So a chemical company can put a chemical on the market without proving that it's safe first, and then they don't even have to provide any kind of research showing how people might be exposed to this chemical. The very basic studies they have to provide to the EPA, they can actually cite confidentiality provisions on, so independent scientists can have a tough time studying whether this is happening or whether people are being exposed to it. And then over time, what's happened with a number of chemicals that have been phased out, think of the phthalates that were in baby products, and also bisphenol A or BPA that was in baby bottles. Consumer pressure eventually led to those chemicals being phased out. The law, TSCA as it's called, really was powerless, or largely powerless, to do anything. It's a law that has so few teeth in it that even asbestos, you know, something very well documented carcinogen that's killed thousands of people. I think the Sun won a Pulitzer Prize for the number of asbestos cases from ship workers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right, the shipbreakers.
Many years ago, the EPA couldn't even ban asbestos because the federal court ruled that the EPA did not prove that it could pose a reasonable risk to people. So that's kind of absurd and Orwellian.
Michael, so did you and your colleagues at the Tribune kind of discover the lack of regulation when you look specifically at flame retardants?
Well, the flame retardant issue was one. That's part of it. I think what we were really looking at was not only was the law unable to address the problem of flame retardants, or the idea that when one chemical is taken off the market, it can be substituted by another chemical that may be equally as dangerous. Or in the case of one particular flame retardant, back in the 1970s, it was commonly added to children's pajamas. It's called chlorinated tris. It's kind of the buzz name for it. There's a long chemical name for the actual chemical. But there was a study published in 1978 that found that it could mutate DNA, and that could lead to cancer. And that led companies to take it off the market for children's pajamas, and eventually the Consumer Product Safety Commission banned that for the use of in children's pajamas. Well, but it didn't ban the chemical, or the EPA didn't ban the chemical outright. So what ended up happening was the chemical industry got caught with another flame retardant called Penta. It used to be the most common flame retardant that was added to foam cushions and furniture. Well, a lot of studies started building up showing that this chemical was dangerous. It was accumulating in mother's breast milk. It was being passed on to children. There were these higher levels showing up in people across the world. American babies were being born with higher levels of this chemical in their bodies than babies in any other part of the world. So the manufacturer pulled it off the market, and what happened to the flame retardant industry? They went back to the same chemical called chlorinated tris that had been taken out of children's pajamas in the 1970s.
And the reason we need these flame retardants in the first place...
That's a wow. I'm sorry. Go ahead,
no,
Rhoda.
No, it's okay. No, it is a wow. I mean, but the reason we need these flame retardants in the first place is because the tobacco industry was supposed to make a cigarette that burned more slowly.
Oh, yeah.
But instead of doing that, they decided...
Well, there's that element, right, too. So, it's like peeling the layers of an onion back, which often happens in investigative journalism. So I think we were surprised, as kind of jaded journalists, to trace this back, and it all starts with the tobacco industry. And eventually a particular lobbyist who linked the tobacco industry with the chemical industry, and they found common cause, and they convinced the state of California to adopt this fire safety regulation. That industry decided the easiest and most cost-effective way to meet that particular standard, flammability standard in California, was to add flame retardant chemicals to foam cushions. And it seems like a great idea, right? You don't want to die in a fire.
Well, you don't want to die when your cushion releases brominated flame retardants either, right?
I mean, exactly. Well, and the chemical industry, when people would push back on them, they had this very dramatic commercial with a couch catching on fire, and this tagline was, "Are you sitting comfortably?" But what ended up happening when fire safety scientists started looking at how flame retardants are actually used in furniture, or were used in furniture, the amount of flame retardants added to foam cushions could meet this really obscure flammability test in California that manufacturers adopted for products sold nationwide, but it didn't actually provide any meaningful protection from fire.
I mean, ask this question. When we use the word toxin or toxic, we're saying this is a substance that generally correlates to cancer risk. Or it's something that if you consumed it on its own, if it wasn't, diluted into a liquid that was used to treat, say, a couch or something, it would be toxic to you. Is that generally what we mean?
Well, you often hear from people who are, I guess, apologists for the chemical industry. Well, hey, even water can be toxic at a certain dose. There's an old adage in toxicology, the dose makes the poison. So traditional toxicology, when they're trying to figure out if a particular substance is harmful, they'll take a test rat and they'll dose the test rats up to a certain point when they die, and then they back it up where they start seeing these other effects, and then they decide, they apply all these different safety factors and whatnot and decide, okay, here's the safe dose of this chemical. But in recent years, increasing number of scientists have started looking at certain chemicals, especially these flame retardants and other chemicals that are showing up in household products, and they act like hormones at very low, and hormones are designed to work at very, very low levels. So it's not the dose makes the poison, it's actually at these low levels, they mimic, say, estrogen or other hormones, and they alter the development of a young child or a child in the womb at a very early age, and what happens is there are problems on down the line, not necessarily cancer even, We're talking impaired fertility, developmental problems, reduced IQ, what the scientists call non-cancer effects.
Michael, but
when kind of multiplied over an entire population can cause serious problems.
Michael, I need to ask you this. We're down to our last 2-3 minutes together. So the model for putting a new product on the market that involves chemicals or a chemical is still put it on the market and then test it later and get back to the Consumer Product Safety Commission or the federal government in some form. Is that still the model we have in place generally?
It is. It's largely a buyer beware. And oftentimes with, you know, there was one particular flame retardant that we found that was a replacement for this one called Penta that used to be in furniture. Because the company that made it cited business confidentiality, scientists, independent scientists, didn't even know the chemical makeup of this flame retardant. And it wasn't until a handful of scientists started seeing this mystery chemical out in the environment, started finding it all over the planet, that they slowly figured out what it was. And it's only now that studies are being done showing what low levels of this chemical can do to animals. And now they're finding it in people, too. So this what a lot of people call is like a whack-a-mole process. You knock one down, another one pops up.
I had a question, Michael, about the work that you've done has led to some furniture companies saying they will not sell these products anymore. And I'm wondering, given the inability or the reluctance of the EPA to regulate these substances, do you think consumers are going to be pushing this issue and getting these chemicals out of our nursing pillows and our couch cushions?
Cribs.
Yeah, we're seeing that already in a whole variety of areas. And states like California, Washington, Maine, they're playing a role in this by adopting their own legislation in the absence of federal action. But consumers are playing a big role on this. But you can't really rely on the consumer to be a chemical safety expert.
Right.
It's tough, and often, you know, what are you supposed to really care about as a parent, for example? Which one of these things are we supposed to worry about? That's why we pay our tax dollars to agencies like the EPA to protect us from these things. And by all accounts, at this point, the system is not working.
Well, Michael Hawthorne, Chicago Tribune, thank you very much for spending this time with us. We were able to find this what should we say? It's a sort of a multimedia adventure on the Tribune website called Playing with Fire, which brings together the entire series, and it's an app, I think. Anyway.
It's terrific. It's really
it's
worth
good.
Reading.
So I put that, there's a link to that on our Facebook page, the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page, if you want to read that, if you hadn't had a chance to read it earlier when it appeared, at least parts of it appeared in the Baltimore Sun. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
Yeah, boy, this is a subject we ought to tackle in more depth, I think, on
Definitely.
Another show.
Definitely. We should have both these guests back and more.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Rona, for bringing them to us.
Thank you.
Rona Cabell joins us once a month for Midday on the Bay. She writes for the Bay Journal, and you have a wrap-up on the General Assembly.
I do.
On the Bay Journal now.
It's on our Facebook page and on our web page, and I think it's on your Facebook page now, too.
It's ChesapeakeBayJournal.com.
BayJournal.com.
BayJournal.com. I keep making that mistake. It's BayJournal.com,
right.
And you can get a subscription delivered to your home with the printed version.
Absolutely.
For free.
For free.
We always mention that.
Yes.
So thank you for being here, Rona.
Thank you so much.
And please enjoy lunch today from two sources. One, Brian Voltaggio and his staff at his restaurants brought us lunch in a big brown paper bag. And we also have delicious lunch served every Thursday and provided for us by Eddie's of Roland Park, offering catering, gourmet sandwiches, personal shopping, and more at its two stores, Roland Avenue and North Charles Street. Eddie'sofRolandPark.com for directions and menus. Have a great afternoon, folks. See you for Midday Friday.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Alexis Kuhn, Aaron Morenzi, and Mary Troutman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.